Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 20th of June, these are our main stories. A major international search operation is launched after a submersible with five people on board goes missing on its way to explore the wreck of the Titanic. The United Nations appeals for international help as Sudan remains in the grip of a bloody conflict. And could a nap a day help keep brain shrinkage at bay? Also in this podcast, the terrifying tale of the Pakistani man who was captured by militants and kept for nearly 5 years. And
can I accept my body for what it is?
After all, we all came into the world naked, didn't we?
The campaign to expand nude sunbathing on a UK island. But first, it could be an adventure of a lifetime, the chance to go deep into the Atlantic Ocean to view the world's most famous shipwreck, the Titanic. But a submersible with five people on board has gone missing. Rear Admiral John Margo of the US Coast Guards is leading the search and rescue mission.
The location of the search is approximately 900 miles east of Cape Cod in a water depth of roughly 13,000 feet. It is a remote area, and it is a challenge to conduct a search in that remote area. But we are deploying all available assets to make sure that we can locate the craft and rescue the people on board.
David Pogue is a CBS News correspondent who travelled on the same submersible last year.
It's a tube, 5-inch thick carbon fiber, about the size of a minivan, with these titanium half-dome end caps on each end. There's no seating inside. You're all sitting on the floor, the five of you. There is no view out except for a 21-inch round porthole at one end. And, of course, there are cameras on the outside. So it takes about 2.5 hours to get to the bottom. They play music. You joke. You get excited. I never got to see the Titanic, by the way. On my expedition down, there was a mechanical problem shortly after the dive began. Turns out that's the norm. They go out for 5 days at a time with passengers, and usually they see the Titanic successfully only once.
Our correspondent Jessica Parker is in Boston, where the search is being coordinated from.
So we've been hearing from the Boston Coast Guard, who are leading this search operation that's now become an international search operation. The US is involved, Canadian officials as well. I'm stood in Boston Harbour and about 900 miles off the east coast here. That's where the search operation is taking place. Obviously, it's going to be a very remote area that they're looking in around the wreckage site of the Titanic. And the focus will be to try and find the vessel. What they've said is they're looking on the surface of the water, if somehow the sub has made its way back up to the surface, but also trying to look under the water as well using sonar technology. Aircraft have been deployed to the area as well. Clearly, if the vessel is still under the water, and depending how deep it may be, that does make things more difficult. And because of the limited oxygen supplies on board, that would also mean there's also a limited window in which to find it.
And what more do we know about the people that are on board this sub?
So it's been confirmed that five people are on board, including one pilot. And among the people believed to be on board is the British businessman and explorer Hamish Harding. Now, he is chairman of an aviation firm. He's something of an explorer. He's gone to the South Pole a number of times, a skydiver. But actually, the people on board aren't being publicly named by officials at the moment. What they're saying is their focus is to try and find the vessel, work with the families, and that's what they're really looking at right now.
And someone was saying earlier, it could be like a needle in a haystack, essentially, with that amount of water and the depths as well.
I think a lot of people are saying that this is going to be very challenging. Clearly, they know at what point or at which point the vessel began its dive, but they are trying to search a stretch of ocean and they don't know at the moment what has happened to this vessel. So I don't think anybody's pretending that this is anything but a very difficult search operation at the moment.
Our correspondent, Jessica Parker, in Boston. With little sign of an end to the fighting between rival military factions in Sudan, the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has called on the world to act now to help the country. The humanitarian crisis has displaced more than 700,000 people inside Sudan and forced about 200,000 to flee into neighbouring countries. Last month, the UN launched an appeal for $3 billion to help 18 million people. But up to now, less than 17% has been raised. Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton, told us what the UN had been saying.
They've been saying that the crisis would require sustained financial support, and they hope that Sudan would be kept at the top of international priorities. Now, the conflict has turned the capital, Khartoum, into a war zone, and Darfur in the west is beginning to resemble the genocide of 20 years ago. And Antonio Guterres reminded the conference just how bad the situation in Sudan is.
The scale and speed of Sudan's descent into death and destruction is unprecedented. Without strong international support, Sudan could quickly become a locus of lawlessness, radiating insecurity across the region. Hundreds of civilians have been killed and many thousands more injured, and these numbers grow by the day. The situation in Darfur and Khartoum is catastrophic. Fighting is raging, with people attacked in their homes and on the streets. Entire neighborhoods have no running water and limited electricity supplies, and more than two-thirds of hospitals near areas of conflict cannot function.
And the UN launched this appeal for money, but it doesn't sound like all of it's been raised or even a huge amount's been raised.
Well, they've actually announced, and I'm quite surprised by this, that international donors have pledged $1.5 billion. They were hoping to raise $3 billion, but it doesn't mean that that money is physically in the hands of the United Nations or its aid agencies. And even if it was, it would be difficult to get the aid supplies into the conflict zones because aid convoys have frequently been looted. The World Food Programme has said that convoys have been attacked. And this would, you'd think, would act as a deterrent to donors pledging money. There's a three-day ceasefire currently in operation, so that's halfway through now. And that ceasefire seems to be holding, but at the same time, looting is on the rise. There are reports of terrible atrocities in Darfur. The medical charity MSF has been speaking to people that have fled across the border into Chad. A 25-year-old man said, "I saw many dead and wounded people lying on the ground. They'd been shot." And someone else said her sister was taken by armed men in a bus and raped. And she said her sister was only 15 years old. And the UN human rights chief, Volker Turk, said they'd received reports of sexual violence against more than 50 women and girls, and they particularly blame this RSF paramilitary for being behind that.
Richard Hamilton. Japan has published the results of an investigation into a government eugenics policy, which until the 1990s saw 25,000 people with supposed mental and hereditary disabilities undergo sterilisation. Will Leonardo reports.
This extensive report has highlighted some of the most egregious cases arising from post-war Japanese legislation that sought to prevent those deemed to be impaired from having babies. Studying thousands of remaining documents, parliamentary investigators found children as young as 9 were made to have sterilisation procedures. In other cases, it was made a condition for receiving benefits or being able to marry. The report also documents people being operated on under false pretenses, including having an appendix removed. More than half those sterilised didn't give consent, while many others were under duress. Definitions of impairment were loose, including hereditary feeble-mindedness. While checks were supposed to be in place, in practice sterilisation decisions were often waved through, and banned invasive procedures such as irradiation and the removal of the uterus were common.
Will Leonardo. Now, let's return to a story we covered in our earlier podcast, because at least five Palestinians are now known to have been killed and more than 90 injured in a fierce gun battle lasting much of Monday in the occupied West Bank. A number of Israeli soldiers were also wounded. Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, told me more about what happened.
This is a military raid which, to be honest, Israel has described as nothing out of the norm. I mean, there have been almost daily raids into the occupied West Bank by the Israeli military for more than a year. Jenin, the town, has been one that has perhaps seen the most clashes. Usually these operations are to arrest suspects, and that is the case with the one that happened earlier this morning. Two Palestinian militants, the Israeli forces, were trying to arrest. But they were met, perhaps with more power than usual, from the Palestinian militants. An IED seems to have been placed and has hit a military jeep. That caused several casualties to Israeli soldiers. The latest figures saying that 8 Israeli soldiers were injured. And Israel then brought in a helicopter gunship to facilitate extricating the wounded soldiers to safety. The gunship fired missiles, and this is the first time that that's happened for over 20 years in Jenin and in the West Bank. So that's quite a serious escalation. On the Palestinian side, at least 5 Palestinians were killed. 3 of them have been named as members of a militant group. One was a 15-year-old boy. So this has been a major gun battle which lasted for many hours.
And has there been any criticism of using a helicopter gunship, given that you can't be as surgical with that kind of weapon?
I mean, the criticism of that, if it comes, would probably be from the UN or from the US. As far as the Palestinians are concerned, I mean, they regard pretty much everything that Israel does in the occupied West Bank, you know, as a crime against them. But I think what the Palestinians have from their side is, although, again, 5 Palestinians were killed, many were wounded, they'll see the fact that the resistance, as they call it, was stronger than it's been so far, and that several Israeli soldiers were wounded. They'll see that as a kind of victory, as sending a message to Israel.
Sebastian Usher. As the war in Ukraine rages on, Britain has announced new plans to change the purpose of sanctions against Russia. It hopes the changes will mean that Russian money will eventually be used to help rebuild the country it invaded. Our reporter Beth Timmons has more.
The new laws tighten Britain's sanctions policy to keep Russian assets frozen until the country agrees to pay compensation to Ukraine. It's the first government to take this step. Other Western countries haven't gone as far, believing it could set a precedent for their assets held overseas to also be seized. Since the invasion of Ukraine, the UK has frozen more than $23 billion in assets and sanctioned more than 1,500 Russian nationals. This list includes Roman Abramovich, the former owner of Chelsea Football Club, and Alisher Usmanov, who has also had significant interest in English football. The new laws will mean that any person who's been designated under the sanctions has to disclose assets held in Britain. Failing to do so will now lead to fines or seizure of these assets. Britain has faced criticism that it's taken too long to target Russians with links to President Vladimir Putin. The BBC has contacted the British government for its response. I asked Daniel Bruce, head of anti-corruption group Transparency International, what impact he thought the new laws would have.
The challenge is that you can only sanction what you can see. So as well as these improvements, we need to see government make it totally impossible to own property in the UK anonymously, which has so often been linked to the kind of assets that government wants to sanction. We estimated in our research that £5 billion worth of property linked to the Kremlin and the Russian regime was sitting in London around the time the war started. So the UK does have a particularly difficult reputation compared to other advanced economies on this issue.
The UK also said there would be a new route for these frozen assets to be donated directly to the reconstruction of Ukraine. But though this $23 billion in assets seems like a big number, the latest estimated cost of rebuilding Ukraine is more than $400 billion, according to the World Bank and the UN. So how soon could Ukraine see this compensation?
The challenging truth is that it can often be a very long legal slog to get relatively small amounts of money. So, you know, a strengthened regime to make that possible is a step in the right direction, but I think it could be legally very complex.
Daniel Bruce from Transparency International, ending that report by Beth Timmons. Still to come on the Global News podcast, why a property deal in Jerusalem's ancient old city has caused fury among the Armenian community. The Australian Parliament has passed legislation that will pave the way for a referendum on giving Indigenous people a bigger say in national affairs. It's expected to be later this year. Malandiri McCarthy is an Indigenous woman and senator for the governing Labor Party.
For First Nations people, this news today, in particular our supporters, has been a wonderful achievement. Obviously, the hard yards are ahead of us, but we're enormously pleased that now it can go to the Australian people. It has been a long time coming. Certainly our elders, our leaders, who've been on this path for decades, long before I have. This is an historic day for us.
Our correspondent in Sydney, Phil Mercer, has more details.
Well, this referendum will ask Australians to recognise the country's original inhabitants in the Constitution for the first time by setting up that powerful panel that would guide official policy called the Indigenous Voice to Parliament. Now, its supporters claim that many current and previous policies that have tried to combat Aboriginal disadvantage have failed, and that the Voice offers a new collaborative approach that First Nations communities would have direct communication with politicians and decision makers, and that would make a practical difference to life expectancy, to education, poverty and imprisonment. And the government says that until the Constitution recognises First Nations people, Australia is a nation missing its heart. But there are critics who believe that the reform is simply a white elitist project that won't tackle poverty or discrimination. They believe that the proposal will cast First Nations people as separate to everyone else in this country and foster disunity. And also there are concerns that this would simply add another layer of bureaucracy to the decision-making process.
That was Phil Mercer. A property deal in Jerusalem's ancient old city, which lies at the heart of the Israel-Palestinian conflict, has caused anger among the historic Armenian community. One quarter of their land, long of interest to Israeli settlers, was secretly sold to a Jewish businessman on a long-term lease. Armenian residents now fear losing some of their homes and their way of life. The controversy, which has led Jordan and the Palestinians to stop recognising the local head of the Armenian Orthodox Church, has also sparked wider fears for the Christian presence in the old city. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolan Nell.
On the stone streets of Jerusalem's Armenian quarter, two suited men with ceremonial walking sticks and felt tasseled hats lead a procession of priests dressed in dark robes and headdresses down towards the Holy Sepulchre Church. There have been Armenians in Jerusalem for over 1,500 years. They have a share in the holiest Christian sites and their own part of the old city.
We know that the entire area, which is called the Cow's Garden, Armenian Garden, is included in the deal. Five houses, also the whole of the seminary is included.
But now the community feels under threat because of a murky real estate deal by its own church. I'm being shown around by Armenian activist Hagop Dejanazian.
It's like a puzzle. I mean, we are trying to know what happened, when it happened, and how.
It appears that a Jewish Australian businessman has bought a large chunk of land for a luxury resort by the old city walls on a 99-year lease.
This deal may put in great danger the long-term Armenian presence in Jerusalem. We want to stay here, we want to live here, because this is our spiritual homeland.
By the time of the colourful Orthodox Easter celebration in April, alarm was spreading. The Armenian patriarch admitted signing away the land, but blamed a priest for deceiving him. Then there were angry scenes as that defrocked priest fled one night, protected by Israeli police. Armenians yelling out, "Traitor!" Now, many in the 2,000-strong Armenian community here have been joining weekly protests. But Jerusalem lies at the core of the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and the implications of this sell-off are being felt way beyond the Armenian quarter.
It undermines any future political solution to Jerusalem. As you know, according to international law, it's an occupied land that is subject to negotiations.
Dimitri Dilyani is president of the National Christian Coalition of the Holy Land. We meet at Jaffa Gate, the iconic entrance to the old city's Christian quarter. And there's a reminder here of how plots of land are fiercely fought over. Two landmark Palestinian-run hotels were secretly sold to radical Jewish settlers by the Greek Orthodox Church. Mr. Dilyani says the Armenian deal is a new worry.
It enforces the illegal settler presence in Palestinian East Jerusalem. On top of that, it kind of infringes upon the mosaic of the old city of Jerusalem, where the diversity is the main character of the city.
In his small ceramics shop, Garo Sandruni is painting glaze in an ornate pattern onto a pottery bowl. He's from one of the Armenian families that moved to Jerusalem a century ago. He says that Armenians historically donated money to buy land here and that the church has no right to sell it.
What makes us angry? These lands belong to the Armenian nation. It doesn't belong to the Armenian Patriarchate of Jerusalem. The Armenian Patriarchate of Jerusalem takes care of these lands to keep them, to preserve them, to protect them.
Now, while age-old Armenian church rituals continue, the patriarch isn't joining in. Jordan and Palestinian leaders have stopped recognizing him, and he's staying out of public view. As the Armenian community worries about the next steps, this controversy has touched sensitive nerves in the Holy City.
Yolan Nell reporting from Jerusalem. In 2011, Shabazz Tazir was kidnapped from his car on the way to work in the Pakistani city of Lahore. The men who took him were Uzbeks affiliated to the Islamic State group, and they held him for years. His abduction took place just months after his father, Salman Tazir, was assassinated by his bodyguard for defending a Christian woman who was facing the death penalty after being convicted for blasphemy against Islam. Shabazz Tazir spoke to Razia Iqbal about his extraordinary story. And a warning, some of you may find parts of his interview distressing.
In my wildest dreams, I didn't think that these men are militants, that I am about to go for 5 years. It didn't even cross my mind. Even though there were about 10 of them with Kalashnikovs, I was relatively calm. I got out with my hands up. I had a watch and some money. I took it out. I said, take it, let me go. And they just rushed me into the back of the car and they kept hitting me and they drove off very quickly. And I'll never forget the man who turned out to be my kidnapper, Muhammad Ali. He was sitting in the front seat and he turned around and he just looked at me and he goes, I've come for you, Shabazz. That was the first time I experienced a kind of fear that I've never experienced in my life. I've never been able to explain that fear that I felt in those few seconds in the back of the car, because as soon as he told me that he's come for me, they pulled out these injections that were filled with this drug called ketamine, which is a horse tranquilizer, and they injected it directly into my veins and they kept doing it for 3 days. So I was not even conscious. And when I eventually woke up, I was in a car to Waziristan, which is a place where men go to disappear or die.
In the northwest of Pakistan.
In the northwest of Pakistan. It's very interesting. Out of all these militant groups, the Pakistani Taliban were the first ones to carve out territory. ISIS came later and took parts of Syria and Iraq. But the Pakistani Taliban in 2011 was the most dangerous terrorist group.
But you were held by a different group that was affiliated to ISIS.
Yes, I was held by an Uzbek group called the IMU. You know, they were the military wing of the Afghan Taliban. And as soon as ISIS came into being and these extravagant murder videos of, you know, innocent people being beheaded and put in cages, and the first people to join them were my abductors.
And you were tortured really quite brutally.
It wasn't just physical torture, but I was also kept in solitary. And it wasn't just my abductor, but all the guards that would come to look after me as well. They would look at me with a very demeaning look in their eyes, almost as if my body and being was there to be used and abused by them and broken. The torture started with lashings, pulling my nails out. They started pulling flesh from my back. They sewed my mouth shut, didn't let me eat for a week. Then they sleep deprived me for another week. And as soon as these extensive torture videos were made and sent to my mother, they would throw me in solitary. And they used to tell me that we're doing all this to you for Allah. Culturally, I'm a Muslim. I'm born in a Muslim country. My father is a Muslim. My mother is a Muslim. And so I couldn't understand, why is there such difference between what I think and what these people think? But when you can take human life without a care in the world, you are closer to being an animal than you are to being a human.
When you were in the midst of this brutality, there were also kindnesses. You were allowed to listen to the radio. You were allowed to listen to specifically Manchester United, a team that you support. How did that come about?
What happened was that one of my guards was a young boy. He was Tajik and he was an illegal immigrant in Manchester and committed a petty crime and had to run. From Manchester, he ended up in Waziristan with these Uzbeks. You know, he loved Man United. And when you love Man United, it doesn't matter if you're a terrorist or Shahbaz Taseer. And one thing led to another. And suddenly, in complete silence with headphones on, we're sitting in this dungeon listening to Manchester United games. But the real kindness that I found there was actually from my abductor's mother-in-law, who was the wife of the man who formed the group. And her son and her stopped my torture. They stopped this madman from basically ripping me into shreds.
They were holding you for a very long time, sending these brutal videos to your mother. Were they asking for money?
They did. The demand was at 4 billion Pakistani rupees, which was about 55 million pounds. I think it is the highest ransom ever asked of an individual. It wasn't just about the money. They also had 25 of the highest ranking commanders from that area on that list, including my father's murderer. One of the interesting things about hope is that you can never give up. And one madman like Mumtaz Qadri or a few illiterate clerics should not represent us.
That was Shahbaz Taseer speaking to Razia Iqbal. Researchers have shown regularly finding time for a nap is good for the brain and could slow down the process of shrinking that comes with age. That's according to a study published by researchers from University College London and the University of the Republic in Uruguay. With more details, here's James Gallagher.
If you've ever fancied finding a quiet corner and just nodding off for 10 minutes of peace, then science might be on your side. Some people's DNA or genetic code makes them more likely to nap. So the team at University College London compared those who were genetic nappers with those primed to power through the day. The results, published in the journal Sleep Health, showed a napping trait led to brains that were 15 cubic centimetres larger. The team said that was equivalent to delaying brain ageing by 3 to 6 years. It's not clear whether napping would also help prevent diseases like Alzheimer's, but the researchers said advising people to nap for up to half an hour was a lot more achievable than exercise or weight loss.
That is such a good news story, isn't it? That was James Gallagher. Finally, the Isle of Wight is an island off the south coast of the UK with a major tourist industry and an ageing population. It's said to have the best climate in Britain and some lovely beaches. The perfect combination for sunbathing, then. But what type of sunbathing? The question has triggered a lively debate among islanders and tourists because a group of islanders are promoting what's known as clothing optional tourism. They want to expand the Sandown Beach naturist area there and encourage more sunbathing in the nude. Others, however, disagree. Johnny Diamond spoke to Pamela Fraser, a nude sunbathing enthusiast, and Councillor Carl Love, the Vice Chairman of the Isle of Wight Council, and he backs an expansion of the nudist beach.
It's the perfect place on our wonderful sun-soaked beaches here on the Isle of Wight to look at clothing optional tourism. I mean, it could bring a lot of tourism to the island. And rather than being secretive about taking our clothes off, I mean, after all, we all came into the world naked, didn't we? Why shouldn't we be much more inclusive and diverse?
Are you a clothing optional kind of guy?
I have in the past, but these days I'm more concerned about long lenses and cameras.
You think you might be a target of the paparazzi? Pamela, there's a lot more talk about diversity of nearly everything these days. Do you think the time has come now, finally, for people to divest themselves of garments?
I do believe that godforsaken thing that we don't really talk about, COVID, actually helped people kind of accept their own bodies and accept their own skin. And people tried naturism at home at that point. And I think, do they think, do you know what? I won't get dressed this morning when I go and make my coffee. I'm just going to stay as I am. And people could be a bit more leisureful and saying, can I accept my body for what it is and not make it who I am? If you look at your body and just kind of say, do you know what? I've got flaws, we all do, and that's that, and you just crack on, you almost free yourself of that negativity that you layer onto yourself. To anybody, would you go to the beach right now, you know, as you are sort of thing, and just strip off? People would say no. People aren't always ready because, you know, they have this thing of like beach body ready.
I've got a letter in front of me of an Isle of Wight holidaymaker complaining about the sight of bare flesh on Isle of Wight beaches. There will be some people who just don't like it.
It's not for everybody and everybody doesn't want to engage. But the point is that we're an inclusive, embracing society. So, you know, let's get with it. Let's be real. Well, this is the sunniest place in the UK anyway.
That was Pamela Fraser and Carl Love speaking to my colleague Johnny Diamond. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin and I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.